This is the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast, episode 120. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy and Sci-Fi Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the whole title says about it. It is a show where we focus on everything to do with fantasy and sci-fi books, whether we talk about epic fantasy, urban fantasy, grimdark, swords and sorcery, space opera, pure sci-fi, you name it, we bring you the best and brightest authors from all the various corners of the fantasy and sci-fi book world to bring here on the show. Kicking off things this week, I'm starting now on my new book, The Paramedics Amazon. It is book 8 in the Extreme Medical Services series about paramedics who treat supernatural creatures, and I'm really excited about getting back into this series. I haven't written any books in this series for over a year now, maybe even a little bit longer, almost closer to 2 years. I'm excited. It's my first series. It's kind of like visiting old friends to get back into these books. If you haven't read any of these books or want to reread them, you can check them out. Book one is called Extreme Medical Services, the same name as the series itself. So check it out, and you'll be able to find that wherever you buy ebooks. And of course, there are also audiobook versions of that available as well. You can check out more information about what I'm up to at any time, including sneak peeks of upcoming covers, special giveaways, and more. Just visit my fan and reader group over on Facebook. That's Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers. And, of course, over at my website and blog, jamiedavisbooks.com. I look forward to hearing from you all, and I hope you will continue to check out what's going on in the group over there. Let's go ahead and get into today's interview. I got the chance to sit down and chat with MJ Neary. MJ describes herself as a self-centered, only child of classical musicians. She spent her early years in Eastern Europe and came to the U.S. at the age of 13. Her literary career revolves around depicting military and social disasters, from things like the Charge of the Light Brigade to the Irish Famine to the Easter Rising in Dublin, which even covers some things about the nuclear explosion in Chernobyl, which was actually 30 miles away from the town she grew up in. She claims to be notorious for her abrasive personality and politically incorrect views, sometimes make her persona non grata in polite circles, but her books are things she uses to explore human suffering through the prism of dark humor, and she believes that tragedy and comedy can go hand in hand. So here's my interview with MJ, where we discuss her book, The Road to Monfalcon. And it was a great time chatting with MJ. We touched on a few dark topics, which is really, you know, things that her book covers, and talked about the role of anger in not just characters, but in people in general. So check it out. Hi, MJ. It's great to have you here on the Books and Authors Fantasy and Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to the show.
Wonderful. I'm so delighted to be here.
So why don't you introduce yourself to our audience of readers out there and let them know a little bit about your background.
Well, fabulous. It's one of those questions I always struggle answering without ruffling some feathers. People always ask me, oh, you have this weird, you're a trashy accent. Where are you from? And I tell them, I come from privilege. And that usually shuts people right up, or they give me those big, scary, wide eyes. Oh, how dare you? Was that supposed to mean? So, as you probably read in my biography, I'm an only child of a classical musician couple. So they were very divided ethnically and politically, which kind of led me to explore ethnic and religious conflict in my fiction. In addition to sci-fi and fantasy, I also write military history, and my focus is on Irish nationalism, Irish and also Pan-Slavic nationalism and Baltic nationalism. I basically explore the fates of smaller countries that are in the orbit of larger empires, if that makes any sense.
It makes a ton of sense. And boy, you picked some doozies to dig into there, because those are like the conflicts of the last 200 years revolve around those two, those areas.
And they basically, what you see is a repetition of what has happened before. So I do wish people would spend more time reading history and kind of picking up patterns, because history does repeat itself. There are only so many original situations that can happen. And this is a topic I explore in The Road to Monfaucon. Basically, you work with archetypes, with villains and heroes, and you can find those components in any plot, in any conflict.
You absolutely can. And I'll tell you, as a person who minored in history, because I just couldn't get enough of it, I would have had another major, but I just couldn't fit it in. I read voraciously, especially military history. So I'm very intrigued by your choices of those particular areas of conflict. It's just, you know, there are so many things about people in the world that divide us, even though there's so much about us that is the same. And it always intrigues me too, to see how people find the division rather than the similarities. And that's hard.
And I think it's also very important to explore the concept of victimhood versus villainhood, because what frustrates me about certain mainstream movies is that those characters are so black and white. The geek or the victim is always this mousy, quiet person. But in reality, people don't enjoy picking on weak and meek and mild people. They pick somebody with an edge. They pick somebody with an attitude. And usually aggressors pick those whom they perceive as a threat. This is why I get so livid when everything is black and white, villain, victim, damsel in distress, hero, martyr, or asexual older woman. That just absolutely drives me nuts. And this is why when I write fiction, I try to go against stereotype, I go against archetype, because we are so much more than the memes we post on Facebook. And sometimes that's what characters are. They are meme-worthy material. They're not tangible, complex human beings. And if you understand other people's complexity, you understand that there is less division than we thought before, that we have a lot more in common. We have many similar wounds and similar pressure points and scars. And if you analyze conflict and if you try to understand your adversary, I think you will understand that there is less division, there's more unity.
Absolutely. So to explain the concept or the premise behind Road to Monfaucon.
Wonderful. First of all, Monfaucon translates as Falcon's Mountain. It's a French word. And during the Middle Ages, it used to be a burial place. It was an execution site and a burial place. Basically, bodies would be taken from the center city in Paris and taken to the outskirts and displayed in this structure. It was basically like a big rack, like a big hangar for corpses. And that place is very sinister. It has very sinister connotation for most Europeans, not just people in France. And of course, it has this mystical fascination. So it's referenced in Victor Hugo's Notre Dame de Paris, also known to the English-speaking audiences as the Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's a place where Esmeralda was buried after the execution. And of course, many cinematic adaptations don't follow through with the execution. They tack on the fake happy ending, but in reality, she does end up getting executed and a corpse is being thrown into the basement because she was not a sufficiently important political figure. Her body was not displayed in one of the windows. It was just tossed into the basement. And this is where Quasimodo goes to die with her. So that's how the story really ends. And most producers, most directors don't have the guts to show it. I think last year, nobody really talks about it, but last year there was this horrible fire at the cathedral. And I used that episode. I thought to myself, this is potentially great material for a novel. You could really weave the mystical aspect of it and create a modern plot that echoes back to Hugo's classic. And that's exactly what I did.
Well, the loss in that fire was just such a tragedy from a historical standpoint. I mean, you know, the timbers in that roof alone were historical in the fact of how they were assembled and constructed in the beginning. There's so much history that lies within that place that I could imagine you could just wave your hand across your face and come up with a story of something that was released by that fire, right?
Exactly. It was a perfect time. And also, I think right now it's really important to explore the whole role of law enforcement in modern society, because modern society is very vocal. It's very divided, and it's a lot harder to be in the law enforcement now than it was even 100, 200 years ago. And Victor Hugo, the author of the original novel, he had a very contentious relationship with authority. He was a privileged young man, and he tended to romanticize rebels. And this is a problem I have with him, because he lived a very sheltered life. He really did not have much contact with the outlaws. And as a result, he tended to put them on the pedestal, make them noble and pure and selfless and idealistic. And law enforcement officers were portrayed as very stiff, heartless, cynical. And in my novel, I wanted to kind of reverse that stereotype, because it's so easy to demonize police officers nowadays. I actually wanted to go against that stereotype and show that the cops actually have a very difficult life. And in France, they don't have much authority. They only get 60 bullets a year, and it's only to practice target shooting. So there is a high, high rate of suicide among French cops. And young women suffer from burnout, because a good portion of the French police consists of women. So their day-to-day reality is not really explored in fiction. And if you look back to the original novel, it has a character named Phoebus de Chautefer. He's kind of the bad guy. And I bring him back in a modern setting as a female. She's a descendant of the Chautefer family, and she is a cop in Paris, a 24-year-old girl, skinny, blonde, but she's completely not what you would expect, because beautiful blondes have a bad rap in fiction. They're portrayed as superficial or materialistic. Well, this girl is completely haunted. She is a daughter of a cop, and her father committed suicide. And in Paris, when a cop shoots himself, it's no big deal. If you're lucky, you get a little blurb in the newspaper that says, dead of his own volition. It's a jargon. It's like a tagline. Basically, when a cop shoots him or herself, it's no big deal. It's like, that's what they wanted. We have to respect their choice.
Yeah, that's tough. And I, as a first responder and a former paramedic, and I've known a lot of police officers and the first response community as a whole, as well as veterans and a lot of others, suffer from the demons that they encounter in the course of their work. And it's hard.
And it's really important to understand that we all have our demons. And one of the characters in the novel is actually a reincarnation of Claude Frollo. And of course, directors and producers hate that character. They always make him either this creepy judge, or they make them religious fanatic. And he was neither nor. He was actually a very complex character. He starts off being very sympathetic, but then he becomes a victim of his own intellect and his own ambition in some ways. He is anything but the representation of the church. He is actually at odds with the church doctrine. He is an alchemist, and some of the things that he does in his spare time really puts him at risk. It's actually amazing that he was not executed, because in 15th century, for doing some of the things that he did, you could easily end up on the pyre, because he wasn't that high up in the hierarchy of the church. He was just an archdeacon. He wasn't close to the bishop. And that left him quite vulnerable. And the fact that he chose to adopt a disfigured child with red hair, which was considered demonic at the time, was pretty controversial. He did not endear himself to the people of Paris by doing that. He was this creepy person who played with alchemy and who took guardianship over this demonic child. So he was really endangering himself. And this is something that directors don't like to explore. It's much easier to slap this bigot, religious fanatic, label on him, because it's much easier to work with. But in reality, he was anything but that. So if he lived in the 21st century, he probably would be a psychologist. And that's just what my main character is. He is a modern day psychologist, but he likes to experiment with the mystical component, with the occult, and that kind of makes him similar to Claude Frollo in the original novel.
You explore so many things, and it's interesting because I've always long thought, and I've had this discussion with a lot of authors on the show, that the more depth you have to your villain, the stronger the story is overall. That we often spend a lot more time with our heroes, and they can be one or two dimensional, but a lot of, if there is time spent by a lot of people, it's spent on developing depth in their heroes. But I think as much time or even more time needs to be spent creating a human believable character in the villain, because you need to create someone who believes that they're doing the right thing for the right reasons. And if you can make that believable, they become in some ways almost even more horrifying, I think, in some ways, because of you can see it coming. It's like watching a train wreck.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like I think Milton mentioned, evil is not the opposite of good. It's a perversion of good. It starts off as good. And even the devil, before he was a rebel, he was one of God's angels. And he became a little overconfident, a little overly curious, and that's how Lucifer became Satan. But Lucifer means light. And he was made of the same substance as his brothers in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And it basically shows that you don't get cancer out of thin air. A cancer cell starts off as a good cell, but there's a mutation that happens within it. And once that mutation happens, when the cell starts replicating itself, it gets out of control. So there have been cases of cancer cells reverting back to the normal state, but it's extremely rare. This is why once that process of corruption and perversion starts, it's very hard to stop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Real quick, because I want to make sure we cover a few things before we get out of here, but you talked a little bit in our side conversation we had before the podcast offline that that you really try to really examine the concept of anger.
Yes.
and how that has a physiological effect on the human body that can be manifested and explained in a book.
Yes, and I think anger is almost like an allergic reaction. Some people have no sensitivity to certain ingredients. Some people are bothered a little bit. They get like runny nose, watery eyes, and some people break out in hives and need to be hospitalized. And as a child, I was a very reactive little person. And I don't know why, because I came from a fairly stable home, but I remember being very easily triggered. I remember being very easily angered growing up. I reacted very strongly to the perceived injustices around me And that led, that put me in a very weird position. People would tell me, stop it. Don't attract attention. People are going to think you're crazy. And I always managed to attract antagonism. There was always some sort of conflict around me. I didn't necessarily start it, but I was this catalyst in a conflict. I was very sensitive to bullying, to any kind of discrimination. I had this very strong sense of justice in me. And where I grew up, those kinds of feelings were not encouraged. That kind of reaction was not considered appropriate, especially coming from a girl. Because as a female, I was expected to rise above, hold my head high, and not notice injustice. And I just couldn't look the other way when my classmates who looked Jewish or who looked Asian were getting beat up. And the teachers were not looking. They were averting their eyes. And the principal was not looking. And I felt like I had to step in, even if I was getting my own nose broken. So that was my emotional experience growing up. I was constantly on high alert, constantly looking out for potential acts of aggression. So that made me very vigilant. And on one hand, it was good because it helped me kind of protect myself because I always assumed the worst about people. But on the other hand, it puts a strain in your relationships because you become vigilant and you become defensive. And that makes it difficult to form platonic or romantic relationships.
Well, and that kind of hypervigilance, it wreaks havoc on the body. I mean, the release of all the hormones and the fight or flight reaction that goes on constantly when you're hyper sensitive or hyper vigilant to what everything that's going on around you. You can't maintain that for an extended period of time without having a problem.
And this is how I developed my dark sense of humor. Of course, I can't use it at my day job because I'll get fired. This is why literature is such an outlet for me, because I can be an absolute jerk. I can create really sarcastic characters. I can say things that you'll get fired for in real life, but I won't because it's not really me. It's my character talking.
That's the joy of being an author, is exploring the things in yourself that you can't always explore openly in front of everyone else. And that's something that I think is something that draws a lot of authors to the work. And maybe not in every book, but there are always, even if it's just a character or a theme, they explore those things repeatedly because they have to.
And this is, it's interesting that you bring it up, because I also have a couple of friends who have read drafts of my work, and they said, Marina, why are you so mean? If life is so terrible, why don't you write something sunny? Write something that makes you feel good. I'm like, oh, you totally don't understand me, do you? And this is a gentleman in his 80s. He says, you're a pretty girl. What do you have to be sad about? And I'm like, I am not a pretty girl. I'm in my early 40s now. So I have accumulated enough trauma. And I think this is one of the healthiest ways of dealing with it. But there always will be people who will get spooked by your writing. And they will say, well, life is so terrible. I turn to fiction for solace. I want a happy ending. Give me a Harlequin romance novel. I'm like, well, I cannot make myself write them. It's so important to be authentic when you create. And it's pretty obvious. You can always tell when someone is writing for commercial success or when someone is writing for self-expression.
Yeah, it's true. And I think one of the things that my brand is Fun Fantasy Reads, and for the most part, I write those kind of stories. But there's a series I wrote that I consider dark compared to just about anything else I've ever written. And it's the one series I wrote that my wife doesn't like, because she doesn't like the way it ends. And I'm like, but that's the ending. I think my inner paramedic coming back from being retired and saying, people don't always live.
Yes.
You know, and there are some real, true, honest to God tragedies that happen out there every single day, and it gives you perspective when you see them up close and personal.
My biological father went from being an opera singer to being a nursing home CNA, so I hear stories every day. It's no big deal. I still have a relationship with him. I still talk to him, but when he and my mother were together every night, it was like, I can't believe he must be taking hormones. He sounds like a little castrati, ha, ha, ha. Basically gossiping about his coworkers, his colleagues in the music academy. And now when I talk to him, he's like, you are not going to believe. They have COVID all over the place and they don't protect these old people. So he comes to me to vent. It's the same relationship. He just vents about different things, but with the same dramatic theatrical flair. I think he had a little bit of a CNA in him when he was a singer, and now he still has a little bit of a performer in him now that he is a CNA.
That's a great way to look at that. And it's true. We all manifest different facets of ourselves in different situations, given what we run into. MJ, it seems like we could probably chat a lot longer. I want to make sure we cover everything and make sure folks know where they can find you. Your book is The Road to Monfacon. It is out now, and I would urge people to go and take a look at it. It may not be everyone's cup of tea, as you've been open and honest about, but I think if someone's looking for an interesting exploration of modern characters from a less than modern world, I think would be a good way to put that. It's a good exploration of that, and I would urge people to check it out. Where can folks find you? What's the best way if a reader wants to reach out to you or interact with you? How do you prefer to do that?
They can always find me on Facebook. I have to warn them, they may not like everything that they see, but I do post a fair amount of kitten pictures because I do have a cat breeding practice. So they can ignore my memes and my angry political posts and they can just look at the kitten pictures. It's Marina Julie Neary. They can find me also. I have a blog. It's called Connecticut Commie Soccer Mommy, and that's a book review blog. So they're also welcome to send me some books because I do write reviews and I write really good ones, really thorough ones.
Awesome. Well, MJ, thanks so much for coming on the Books and Authors Fantasy and Sci-Fi podcast. I was enjoying talking to you, and I think you're a great example that, you know, we may have a lot of things different, but we all still like cat pictures. So it's a good thing.
You do, yes.
Take care.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Bye.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. Make sure you catch up with us for a whole lot more from the fantasy and sci-fi focused community. You can find us over on Facebook and, of course, over on fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode and let us know what's on your mind. Also, while you're over there on the website, if you're at the podcast episode post, right below the audio player at the top of each podcast episode page, you can subscribe to the show using your favorite mobile app, whether it's iOS or Android, even by email. Make sure you do that. You don't want to miss any of our upcoming episodes. We've got some amazing authors scheduled over the next few months. That's it for this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at Jamie Davis Books and, of course, at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can get a free book if you sign up for my newsletter while you're over there. So check it out. Whatever you do, though, you want to come back here for the next podcast. And, of course, that's going to be a lot of fun. But in the meantime, don't forget as well to keep your eyes open, folks, because there's magic all around you.